But Mr. Grady, introduce the people you have in front of you, and please go through it. If we had our meeting earlier, just go through each session, tell them what the change of the code, and each one, when we finish each session, if the committee has any questions, we ask you the questions during that time. All right?
Okay.
Mr. Grady.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Grady, Deputy Corporation Counsel. On my right is Attorney Steve Huff from the Reinhart Law Firm, who's the outside tax counsel for the Pension Board and largely drafted the ordinance amendments in the summary. And on my left is Mr. Larry Langer from Buck Consultants, who is the actuary for the retirement system. A couple overviews, and then I think I'm going to have Steve Huff actually do the section-by-section summary because he knows this better than I do.
Okay.
The overview is that the pension plan, like all pension plans, the county pension plan, like all pension plans, must maintain its compliance with the IRS code. And we try to have the ordinance amendments, well, we not only try, but we must have the ordinance amendments be consistent with the IRS code. We periodically have to file with a branch of the IRS for what's called a determination letter, which is their blessing of the pension plan's tax-qualified status. And so in order to do that, you have to tell them that you're in compliance with the IRS code. And so these ordinance amendments have been part of a package given to the IRS as part of our tax qualification filing, as you know, what we'll be proposing to the county board, to the plan sponsor, to adopt. A big chunk of these ordinance amendments relates to a federal law change in 2002 that was made to the IRS code, which the acronym is EGTRRA, E-G-T-R-R-A, Economic Growth and Tax Reconciliation and Recovery Act, something like that. But it was the Congress changing the tax code back in 2002. And for reasons which many of you may remember back in 2002, the county government was preoccupied with other pension matters and not really able to focus on this issue at that time.
Right.
So a large part of these ordinance amendments are being adopted or proposed for adoption now, retroactive to 2002 when the federal law changed. There are a couple other sections, the HART Act and the PPA Act, again, federal actions that have been done more recently to the IRS code that we need to adopt just to maintain that compliance with those federal law changes. I believe that everything in this package is recommended to you by the pension board because it needs these amendments. The pension board is recommending these amendments to maintain its tax-qualified status and consistency with the IRS code. It's my opinion that the county board really should not pick and choose from amongst these. It should adopt these. I think it needs to adopt these in order to maintain compliance. Now, there is going to be an issue and a larger discussion on Thursday in front of the Finance Committee about the purchase of service, the buy-in, buyback issues. And we can explain either now or again then the interrelationship between these ordinance amendments and those issues. Most of those issues are not touched by these amendments, but there is one section of these amendments that does touch on the buy-in issues. And maybe what we do is when we go through them section by section, when we get to that section, we will talk about that particular section. So with that as an overview, I would turn it to Mr. Huff. You should have, just to summarize the packet, you've got a cover memo from myself. Underneath that, you should have a bullet point summary, which is a section by section summary of the various sections.
Madam Clerk, can you give Mr. Cohen a packet you don't have in front of him? Ms. QP, do you have a packet?
I believe I do.
Okay.
No, I don't.
You got this?
Well, I printed this one out.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it.
What you printed out.
Okay, Mr. Grady, please go. Continue.
So underneath, there's a bullet point summary, which is a section-by-section summary. There's a one-page document, which is the pension board's motion to the county board recommending these ordinance amendments. Underneath that, you have Mr. Langer's report, which we'll get to. And then underneath that, you actually have the resolution with the ordinance amendment document, which is fairly long and complicated. And then there's a fiscal note at the very bottom.
Right.
And then I have handed out to the clerk, and I think she may have handed it out to you just now, a supplemental memo that the Finance Committee asked me to prepare, talking about the interrelationship between these ordinance amendments and the purchase of service issues. And I just handed that to the clerk, and I think she's given it to you. It's just a two-page memo. And
at the end, we'll get to that section.
We'll get to that at the end, yes.
We'll deal with that.
So with that, I'm going to turn to Mr. Huff, unless there's some immediate questions.
Mr. Huff, are you going over the resolution?
The bullet point. I'm sorry. I think the intention was the bullet point summary.
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
All right. There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. If you want, we could go through the resolution section by section, and that tracks with the order in the bullet point as well.
Okay. Let's go through the resolution.
Okay.
So, 'cause they can stay with you on each line that you go through.
Sure. On section one, which is the amendment to ordinance section 2.7, this is an amendment which...
Excuse me, Mr. Huff, will you please say what line you're on when you...
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, I'm at line 77. And what that change does is it amends the amount of compensation that someone working for a sponsor of a qualified plan can earn and have counted as compensation under the sponsor's qualified plan. So every plan that is a qualified plan under the Internal Revenue Code would essentially adopt this same amendment to say that effective 2002, we're changing that limit from 150,000 to 200,000 as indexed by the IRS for cost of living adjustments, so that figure today is 260,000. So there aren't many employees who are going to be earning at that level, but that's the level that would apply across every qualified plan in America. And this simply makes that change. And it was, as Mr. Grady said, a requirement in 2002 that be amended, and the retirement office has operated as if that was in effect so that there wouldn't be a violation in operation of this requirement. Okay. Item 2, Section 2, I think I'm going to just refer to the entire item, which is line 79 through 103. It applies a number of technical requirements to veterans, people in military service, and provides that certain rights apply to them with respect to wages and death in service. And again, the retirement office has operated as if these had been adopted in 2007 when they were first required.
Okay.
And Section 3, which is the amendment to 4.6, it's roughly from lines 115 through 129.
I'll go back into it.
And unfortunately, and again, 135. All the way through 236, it takes all of that to make some fairly technical changes to the way something applies, and that is the requirement that when somebody turns age 70 and a half and has terminated from service, pension plans, again, this is not just the county's plan, but any plan that's tax qualified, must start paying benefits to them at that time. Unfortunately, the IRS makes it very, very complex to put this into words. So Section 4 limit this to something a little smaller of a section, which is 4.7 of the ordinances. These, again, are mm-hmm. new rules, and there's a change that applies at line 244, then also at 250 through 252, as well as a whole new section at 273 through 304. And what's happening there is that all pension plans must make certain that certain payments get paid within a certain time period. The most important one is that if somebody dies, they have to start paying the beneficiary within 5 years. And your plan already does that, but it's a requirement that you put this long section in to guarantee that that happens. Again, the retirement office has been complying with this all along. The next section is section 4.5, sorry, and that's ordinance section 4.8, subsection 4. That is nothing more than removing an outdated reference to proposed regulations. You'll see on line 328, we're striking out proposed regulation 401A9. The 401A9 regulations are the ones that we've been talking about with 7.5 and death. And IRS is required that we take out a reference to the proposed regulations because they're not proposed regulations anymore, they're regulations. And so the changes that we've been discussing in the last two sections are the ones that apply. So it's a very, very technical change there. In section 6, which is 12.1 paren 3, this is the amendment that revises the minimum benefit permitted under the plan. And that changes by dropping out sections 330, lines 339 through 344 and adding lines 345 through 362. And this refers to a minimum benefit that can be paid without violating the code section we'll refer to a lot, code section 415, which is the maximum benefit payable under the Internal Revenue Code. This is something probably only an actuary could understand. And
Mr. Huff, isn't this what the rule of 75, dealing with people who retire before age 65, I mean 60?
This is not the one. There's another one. You're right. There's another one, but this is not the one. This is the one that talks about a minimum benefit, and it's very, very unduly complex, but required to be in there.
Well, since we got the actuary, come on, talk to her.
It's fascinating. Oh, Larry Langer from Buck Consultants. It's fascinating to me how complex it is, how many paragraphs you need to describe how to limit a benefit from a qualified plan for a person for something that doesn't impact a lot of people within the plan. The vast majority of people within the plan do not come close to the maximum benefit levels that are prescribed within 415. But for those that do, you have to spend a lot of effort to try and make sure that they're in compliance with that rule. It requires all sorts of actuarial tables that, numbers and calculations of that to make sure they're in compliance. Okay. And we work with staff to make sure that's done.
All right. Any questions? Mr. Huff, you can continue.
Okay, and then Section 7, again, unfortunately, it sort of runs the entire section from 364, line 364, all the way through to line 504, again, a very complex statement that really does nothing more than tell the actuary that if somebody is taking a different form of benefit than, say, a straight life annuity where all they're getting is the normal form, just a pension for their life, to some other form of benefit like a 50% joint survivor annuity, that after that happens, they still can't get more than the maximum allowed under the Internal Revenue Code. So you have to have factors that prevent that. And ERS has been complying with that since the beginning, even though it hadn't had these adopted. And there's really no other way to comply with it because the actuaries all have tables that are based upon everybody in America complying with this. So the next one is Section 8, 12.3, parenteron 2. And this is the one you were referring to, Mr. Chairman. The rule of 75 would be impacted by this. It begins on line 508, and it runs through all the way, unfortunately, to 557. And so this is what adjusts the benefit, the maximum benefit, when somebody starts the benefit before age 62. So this is a very important provision because there are people who can retire quite early with the rule of 75, and so it's important to know what the limit would be that applies to them because you have to step down the maximum. And Buck has been supplying those tables to the retirement office for many, many years to prevent that from going over those limits.
So the concept here is that the Internal Revenue Code provides for this is the maximum benefit to be paid to someone at age 65. Well, if you retire at age 60, you're going to receive that benefit for a longer period of time, and so this Section 8 provides for that. Since you're receiving it for a longer period of time, we should adjust the amount, the maximum amount, down. And that's the whole concept there. If you retire 10 years before age 65, the amount of benefit that could be available to you could be as much, as little as 50, 60% of the full amount. And that's the concept. Just make everything equivalent to this benchmark that they've set of a maximum benefit at age 65. It's also somewhat similar to the adjustments we talked about for other form of payments. If you're covering, if your payment form is different from life only, we should adjust it to reflect that.
Okay. Just to follow that up, to reiterate, as with all of these, the actuary has assisted the retirement office to comply with this IRS code requirement, even though it's not been in our ordinances, so that we could maintain our qualified status and comply with the IRS code. And so Buck has provided tables and factors for them to use to comply with this language in the IRS code.
So we have been applying. We are a qualified plan, and we've been within the IRS code to be qualified, correct?
We've been operating consistent with the IRS code. We've submitted our filing to the IRS, and Mr. Huff can give you more details, but I don't think we've gotten a response to the last filing, but we've never gotten a negative response. We have filed for the letter.
Right. Six years ago was the latest filing with the IRS, and there is no determination letter yet from IRS, but it was filed 6 years ago.
So we are in compliance.
You are in compliance in operation with these rules, not in compliance in form until these rules are adopted.
Any questions so far from the committee? All right, Mr. Huff.
All right. Section 9, we should have traded off so that Mr. Langer got this one because this one is the most technical of all. It's Section 12.3, subsection 3, where all they're doing is deleting some old language that's no longer necessary. So, in other words, it's the same thing we just talked about where we're stepping back prior to age 62, but there's some language that related to age 55 as well, and so that's being removed in order to make that section we just talked about work. So essentially the two sections work together for the rule of 75 sort of thing. And then Section 10 is Ordinance Section 12.4, parenteron 1, and that's the Internal Revenue Code Section 415C limit, the limit on what can be contributed to a plan And as you know, you don't have contribution. You didn't have contributions to the plan prior to Act 10, after the 1971 contribution stopped. But there were membership accounts into which some of these buy-in or buyback contributions were made. And so these are the limits that would apply to them. And so it is important that these be looked at as well. And these are required amendments in the sense that the act that was passed by Congress effective 2002 does specify dollar amounts and percentage of compensation. And those are the ones that, you know, to my knowledge, every pension plan sponsor in America adopted to be in lockstep with plan sponsors in administering these laws.
If I could jump in on this one, this is the one section that is addressed in my supplemental memo that does have an effect on the purchase, the buy-ins and buybacks that have been done. The one section in these ordinance amendments. None of the other sections do, but this one does. And because our ordinances were not amended back in 2002 when the federal law changed, our ordinances continued to contain a requirement or a limitation that said you could provide no more than 25% of your compensation in a year as a contribution to the pension plan through a purchase of service. The IRS in 2002, Congress in 2002 changed that 25% to the lesser of $40,000 or 100% of your compensation. And so the pension office allowed those kinds of payments to be made, those contributions, those purchases to be made, even though they were in excess of 25% of someone's compensation in a given year, because the IRS code had been changed to allow up to 100%. This amendment will retroactively change our ordinance to be consistent with the IRS code to change the 25% limit to a 100% limit, which is what the IRS code provides. And again, had we done that in 2002, none of these would have been an issue. We would have just been operating consistent with the code. Because we didn't do it for 12 years, now we've got people who are contributing through purchases of service consistently with the IRS code, but inconsistently with our ordinance. So the memo to the Finance Committee says that upon adoption of this section to maintain consistency with the IRS code, there are approximately 9 people who made purchases of service, buy-ins or buybacks, from January 1st, 2002, when the federal law changed, to 2007, when they were stopped, that would be allowed by the ordinances by this retroactive ordinance change. Those 9 people that's the only error in the administration of their purchase. So this ordinance change will allow those 9 purchases to be considered proper purchases. And they'll be taken from the category of people who have errors in their purchase and put in the category of the 300 and some people who do not have errors in their purchase. There are approximately another 100 people or so who also have this error in their administration that would be cured by this ordinance amendment. But those 100 people, in addition to this error, have some other error, like use of 457 funds or paying back more than 2 years after return to employment. Those additional errors are not solved or not addressed by these ordinance amendments. So it would solve one of the errors related to the administration of their purchase, but it would not solve the other errors. Those ordinance amendments related to those other issues are going to be discussed by the pension board at its next meeting. They're going to consider whether to recommend them to the county board, and then if they do, they will come to the county board at a future date. They are not part of this package. This is the package of ordinance amendments that we believe is required to maintain consistency with the IRS code. Those kinds of ordinance amendments are not, we can't tell you they're required to maintain consistency. So they're separate and will be in a subsequent package.
Any questions? Mr. Huff?
Okay. Section 12 is an amendment to Section 12.8 of the ordinances. And if you look at line 622, it's helping to set a definition because we've said that a member's compensation is measured for purposes of determining how much they can receive from the plan or how much can be contributed to the plan. So it's important to know what's considered compensation. And here, the Internal Revenue Code is dictating that when you determine that definition of compensation, you include 132F4 compensation, which is certain qualified transportation fringe benefits. And also, there's a cash or deferred kind of a plan in 402E3, but I don't think you have that kind of a plan. Mm-hmm. In Section 13, it's exactly the same as what I just said, except if you look at line 629, what's happening is IRS is clarifying now 7 years after the original amendment that it mandated that that compensation must be paid prior to the termination of the employee from service. So if you have compensation that is paid to somebody for transportation fringe benefits after they terminate employment, that doesn't get counted in compensation. But you're talking about things that are at the highest end of compensation for tracking what they can be paid, so it's not going to come into be impacted very much at all. Section 14 is going to include the term 457, but it's not what we might think of as some sort of a correction to the 457 issues that you've been talking about. Rather, with this one, effective 2002, this amendment at line 642 through 648 would allow a rollover out of the plan to a 457 plan. So the Internal Revenue Code requires that if there is a lump sum payment out of the pension plan, it's requiring that not only can that be rolled to an IRA, but that can be also rolled to a 457 plan. So that's a requirement of law. And in fact, there have been some instances that have come up, and because the retirement office is administering the plan in conformity with the Internal Revenue Code, and actually I think these occurred on the OBRA side, they've complied with this even though it hadn't been adopted.
So in other words, if someone did a single lump sum, they can roll their lump sum into the 457 plan, 401k plan, IRA, loans is a qualified plan.
Yes, it's easier to picture with the OBRA accounts because they're much smaller, and you'd get that all at once in many cases. So,
what about their pension now? They say they want to do that.
They're not eligible to get it all at once, to get a single lump sum in order to be able to roll it over.
Okay.
But Mr. Chairman, I think what you do get or can get, some employees can get, is a backdrop. And so a backdrop is, it's not the entire pension, but it's a piece of the pension in a lump sum.
Okay.
And this would allow you, and people have done this because we've been operating consistent with the code, to roll that from the, you know, to receive that payment and then to roll it into our deferred compensation plan, into the 457 plan, or into an outside private 401k plan or a Roth account of some sort. It's allowing you to take that kind of a distribution and roll it out of the plan. So this has nothing to do with money coming into the plan for purchases of service. This has to do with money going out of the plan as a benefit.
All right. Any questions?
Section 15 and 16, if we can take them together, they're really about the same thing. They're both effective in 2010, and Congress went back and forth on a requirement, and IRS went back and forth on a requirement. The net result is, after making both the amendments that's shown at lines 653 through 664 and 673 and 674 is that rollovers can be made to non-spouse beneficiaries to inherited IRAs. So if you had a situation where there was a benefit that is payable to a non-spouse beneficiary in a lump sum, it could be made to an inherited IRA. I don't know of any circumstances like that that have come up, but it's a requirement that this language be added to the plan.
Supervisor Hoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hoff, an inherited IRA, does that refer to inheritance as one would be accustomed to the term in more common terms, or is that a different term of art?
No, I think it's the common term where it belonged to an individual who died and then it was passed on to a spouse or someone else.
Okay. And so this would enable a person to then use the aforementioned rollover to add to that?
To add to that, yes.
Okay. And so this money, the funds for this would come from ERS?
That's why I can't think of a situation where this has come up, right?
Yeah, for me it's purely hypothetical as well.
If we use Mr. Grady's example of the backdrop, a beneficiary wouldn't be eligible to get one, so it wouldn't be that. But maybe in the OBRA context it could come up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Okay.
Mr. Chair, then I'd like to have Mr. Langer just make a few comments about his actuarial report. And then any other questions you have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the commission, January 31, 2014 letter, and you'll see that the proposed amendments line up Section 1 through Section 16 of the lined up with Mr. Huff's amendments. And the bottom line with these, and you heard it over and over again during the discussion, is that, you know, these amendments, the Internal Revenue Service changes the code year after year after year, and these are like routine annual increases in the code, and it's up to the retirement systems to keep up with this. That's the bottom line, and in terms of administration, the retirement system has been administering it in compliance with the code. And so when you take a look at, the analysis that I have here is that, from an ongoing cost statement basis, because the plan's been administered in compliance with these codes, there's no impact as a result of these amendments, because it's not going to change anything going forward. That being said, I mean, if this was something where, like, back when these issues came up, we said, okay, we're about to implement that, these code provisions, would there be an impact? Probably some sort of immaterial impact, yes. But a lot of these codes, when you hear about them and you say, maximum benefits are people who transfer their monies in or out of a plan, I mean, these provisions impact very few members in terms of the actuarial impact on the fund. So the ongoing cost of these amendments, since the plan's been administered in compliance with the code, these set of amendments won't have any impact on the actual, won't have any actuarial impact on the retirement system.
Any questions? In other words, we're just making the change because we have to do this because we have to be in compliance with RIS. But we already,
we're already doing it.
We're doing it. There you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Hall. Supervisor Hall, excuse me.
Thank you, Supervisor. Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
All right, now we're going to start. Let's go.
No, sir. With all due respect, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Yes, in reviewing your letter, Mr. Langer, I noted that a very consistent remark was this will have no impact.
Yeah, it'll have no impact because you're already doing this. If you had a situation where, I'll pick one. I'll probably make a really bad example. Mr. Grady's always better. But let's say we had something that someone's benefit happened to be limited to some amount, And as a result of updating those limits, you know, the amount increased drastically, and then we started paying higher benefits to those people, and there were a lot of them. You know, that would be an impact. But the fact that we've gone through and the retirement system has administered the plan in compliance with these changes that have happened over time, we're not going to have a one-time impact of this because we've been, you know, as things change, the retirement system has been implementing them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hanchak, you have anything to say?
Chairman, no. Ms. Newman would have liked to be here today, but she wasn't able to attend, so I'm just indicating for her case that's needed.
Who?
Marion Newman. She's the IRS manager.
Oh, we got a new one.
Yeah, a little bit of a change within HR. IRS used to report through me.
Correct.
Now they're reporting directly to Carrie Mitchell.
Oh. All right, thank you. Mr. Grady, or Mr. Langman, or Mr. Huff?
I don't think we have anything else. We'll obviously answer any questions you have, but as you know, and as I said at the beginning, the Pension Board is recommending these to the County Board, and as counsel to the system, both outside counsel and in-house counsel, we believe that they're appropriate and necessary to maintain consistency with the IRS code.
All right. What's the pleasure of the committee? We have a motion to move approved. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion. We have a second on this item. Madam Clerk, we do have a motion and we do also have a second. Please call the roll first. Do we have any comments? Any other questions? Call the roll on item number one.
Johnson?
Aye.
Haas?
Aye.
Cuby?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye.
5 ayes, 0 noes. The motion to recommend this for adoption prevails.
And we will be recommending this to the Finance Committee. Any other information and comments or coming forth?